Hundreds of thousands of employees have come and gone from the likes of the CIA and the State Department. Most of them were never relevant. Even fewer have remained relevant after leaving government employment. Our next guest has remained relevant. That hasn't been without controversy. He is not one to tell the Washington swells what they want to hear, but he's earned a place in the mix of voices commenting on contemporary intelligence and foreign policy issues for more than the past two decades. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Larry Johnson is not the typical CIA officer. After spending 4 years at CIA headquarters working in analysis, he transferred to the State Department, where he became a deputy director in the Office of the Counterterrorism Coordinator. He later left government service to found a successful consulting firm. He's also known for a daily blog in which he offers insights, sometimes biting and controversial insights, into current events. And that is what makes Larry Johnson interesting and keeps him relevant. He's not afraid to criticize some of the most powerful people in Washington. He's not afraid to be wrong. Johnson has made some bad calls in the past, but he keeps pushing, and he keeps writing, and he keeps himself relevant in the dog-eat-dog world that is Washington, D.C. Larry Johnson, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you.
Thanks, John.
Tell us a little bit about your career. You started off at the CIA, first going through operational and paramilitary training, and then moving into analysis. You were there for a relatively short period of time, 4 years, before moving over to the State Department. What exactly did you do at the CIA, and why did you make the move to the State Department?
I was not a happy camper. I really did enjoy my time. The first year in the career trainee program was a lot of fun. We got to see all aspects of the agency, and I was fortunate that I got to work on the Afghan task force. This was during the height of U.S. support for the Afghan rebels against the Soviets. Then I got to work on the Central American task force. Then transitioned from that was I started my analytical career as the Honduran analyst, which at the time was one of the top five foreign policy issues for the Reagan administration, which meant that I was regularly writing for the PDB, the National Intelligence Daily. I did discover that there are a lot of analysts out at CIA who go through 3 or 4 years in their career without ever writing for the Presidential Daily Brief. By contrast, I was writing probably two articles a week. So it was that was sort of interesting. My transition to state came because of the terrible management at CIA, is the best way to put it. I had a new branch chief, Mary McCarthy. She came out of an Africa background. She had zero experience with Central America. I'd lived in Central America. I spoke Spanish. And I was asked to provide the front office a list of relevant cables every morning. Remember, this is back in ancient times when we dealt with paper. It was not electronic. So I would cull through, 500 pages of overnight traffic, come up with a select group of messages that I thought the front office should be aware of, and sent that forward. Unbeknownst to me, Mary McCarthy was doing the same thing, except she did not know what she was looking at. And so she was sending some of the most outrageous, outlandish pieces forward. Well, I then later discovered, because it was only when I went in for my performance appraisal report, that they said, well, we didn't promote you, even though I was in the top 10% of analysts in terms of current production and producing research papers and considered an excellent briefer. They said, we didn't promote you because, quote, we have questions about the integrity of your analysis. At that point, I was like that cartoon character, Roger Rabbit, where the eyes completely bug out of the head. And I discovered what had happened is they were getting different traffic from Mary McCarthy than what I was sending forward. And so I asked him just up front, why didn't you call me in the very first day that you noticed this? Why did you let this go on for over a month without pointing out that she didn't know what she was doing, without giving me a chance to explain why I was doing what I was doing? So at that point, and the person who was the deputy in the office at the time, Carmen Medina, you may have run across her at some point, because later she was elevated up the chain of command. Incompetence rises to the top down there. I was fed up. I was furious because I thought this group of incompetents, if this is how they're going to operate, I don't want to be part of it. And then I received an offer I couldn't refuse. Ambassador Busby, who had just been named as the coordinator for counterterrorism at State Department, previously he had been the special envoy for the Central American peace process. And I had regularly briefed him. And so he liked me. He understood that I was competent. And so he asked me to come work for him at State. The only way I could do that was to move as a Schedule B contractor. But frankly, I was so furious with what the agency had done. And mind you, my last 6 months at the CIA, I received two exceptional performance awards. I mean, that shows you just how completely disconnected from reality they are. On the one hand, they say I'm an exceptional performer. And then on the other hand, they got questions about the integrity of my analysis. And they don't have the courage or the integrity to come and confront me about it and say, why are you giving us different information than Mary McCarthy? And I could tell them very simply, because she's ignorant and does not know what she's doing.
When you got to the State Department, you were immediately put into important work in counterterrorism. I know that you were part of a very serious terrorism investigation. I believe that was the Pan Am 103 attack. That must have been rewarding work, but you chose to leave. What led to that decision? The reason I ask is that you almost immediately became a critic of U.S. counterterrorism policy. Can you explain why?
When I arrived at State, my duties were basically I was the deputy director in charge of the anti-terrorism assistance training program. I was in charge of the policies on transportation security, both aviation and maritime, and then provided support for the military special operations. And my very first, within 3 weeks of arriving, we deployed at the time what was considered a top secret team, the emergency support team, to El Salvador. Because Salvadoran guerrillas had, quote, taken members of Delta Force hostage. Now, what actually happened was the guerrillas had stormed this hotel, not realizing there was a Delta Force element inside that hotel. And the Delta guys were armed to the teeth. And once the Salvadoran guerrillas realized what they were up against, they decided, well, it's better not to attack. They backed off. Nonetheless, we deployed this interagency team. That consisted of FBI, CIA, State Department communicators, and State Department officials to El Salvador, along with JSOC as well, deployed its contingent. And I ended up writing the first, what was called the logistics cable, which ironically ends up, it was continuing to be used for that particular mission 20 years later. So I was there for 4 years, and in 1993, my contract, that Schedule B contractor, it was coming due, and the decision of the incoming Clinton administration was we can downsize on the terrorism front, and so my job went away, and I became at that point a contractor.
Almost immediately after leaving government, Larry, you began appearing as a pundit on television shows and news shows around the United States in which you gave commentary. You were prescient in 1998 when you warned Americans about Osama bin Laden. You said that bin Laden, quote, was consumed by hatred and craziness. If not confronted, he would continue to terrorize Americans around the world. He has no compunction about killing women and children. He's a complete egalitarian in his murderous attitude, unquote. But you took some heat in 2001 when you published a piece in the New York Times in which you argued that terrorism was not the biggest challenge that the U.S. faced and that terrorism should not be portrayed that way. Why the change in your analysis?
Well, it's one thing to recognize that there is our terrorist threats out there, and there are particular individuals or groups that can carry out those attacks. But that you've got to put it in perspective. It is not an existential threat by any measure. In fact, terrorism basically, by definition, is the actions of individuals who are weak, who do not have the ability to confront on a military basis a nation. They have to, be more circumspect. And frankly, it's more antagonistic. Part of what I was reacting to and seeing at the time is that terrorism was being trumpeted in a way to it replaced the Soviet threat, the commie threat. previously we had justified massive defense spending because we had to stop the spread of international communism, don't you know? Well, the Soviet Union went away and Russia emerged much weaker, all of a sudden that rationale no longer held up. And you had all these defense contractors clamoring for, hey, how are we going to get fed? Where are we going to get paid? And lo and behold, terrorism, the gift that kept on giving, the events of 9/11, you led to a just complete 180-degree turn in what the United States did. I know right after the Bush administration came in January of 2001, Richard Clark had prepared a very detailed memo laying out what needed to be done to deal with the threat that was posed by Al-Qaeda. And it was a real threat. It was not manufactured. It was genuine. And it was significant in that they were had international organized efforts. But that was rejected. It was ignored. There was supposed to be an interagency meeting chaired at the National Security Council on combating terrorism. That ceased. And the Bush administration was devoting its efforts at the time to promoting building a missile defense system. And note, it was in that summer, I believe, that George W. Bush exited the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And that was important because the United States was planning at the time to try to develop anti-ballistic missile systems that would have frankly posed a threat to Russia. But then came 9/11. Now, I know there are a lot of conspiracy theorists out there that insist that the United States was behind that, but that's not the case. This was a pure example of the combination of bureaucratic incompetence, arrogance, hubris, and then the Bush administration immediately pivoted and made combating terrorism the number one priority. And then anything that was done to combat, anybody who was supporting terrorism in any way became a target. And it's just, you know, the United States policy at that point went completely off the rails. So I would note that in November of 2000, November 7th, I believe, was the precise date, Milt Bearden, the former chief of station in Pakistan that ran the Afghan war in its latter years, and we put together an op-ed. And that op-ed noted that whoever was the next president, because it was still a dispute whether it was going to be Al Gore or George W. Bush, that they needed to deal with two specific threats. Imad Mughniyeh, who had been behind the bombings of the Marine barracks and the U.S. embassies in Beirut in the mid-'80s, and Osama bin Laden. Now, I challenge anybody to go back to November of 2000 and find anybody else that was saying, hey, you need to be prepared to deal with Osama bin Laden. So when I wrote that op-ed in the summer of 2001, I was saying, oh, he doesn't believe that terrorism's a threat. No, I don't believe terrorism is the greatest threat we face. It has to be put into context. It's a threat, it needs to be dealt with, but we don't need to exaggerate it. And it really became sort of a cudgel to beat the public with and used to justify a lot of very, in my view, unsavory and illegal policies.
You have always been outspoken in your opposition to the manipulation of intelligence and intelligence analysis for political purposes. This tailoring of intelligence was especially egregious during the George W. Bush administration, and then Vice President Dick Cheney and his senior staff were famous for cherry-picking intelligence reports that fit their personal ideologies. That led you to be an outspoken critic of the Iraq War and of the CIA's response to the Iraq War. Tell us about that.
I remember I was sitting at the Nixon Center with Patrick Lange and Joe Wilson, among others, Charles Krauthammer. So it was quite a mix of personalities. And this was in January of 2003. And at the time, that was the first time I met Joe Wilson. I didn't realize Joe was married to my former CIA classmate, Valerie Plame. And in no time did Joe go, hey, you know, my wife was a secret agent for, you know, none of that. Never came up. But we're all sort of puzzling about, boy, the U.S. government must really have some top secret intelligence they're not revealing, because none of this makes sense about Iraq. And then as it unfolded, I had a conversation with one of our mutual friends, Fulton. And Fulton at the time was on the National Intelligence Council. And he passed on me. He says, there is no evidence to this. And so at that point, I began speaking out. And I was recorded on National Public Radio with Michelle Norris, I believe, in May, criticizing, saying that there was no justification for this invasion. Interesting is, the previous 6 months prior to that, in November of 2002, I appeared on the Hannity and Combs show. At that time, I was a Fox News analyst. I was getting paid, $1,000 a week, which is a pretty sweet deal. And I was asked about the United States going into Iraq. And I said, the United States was not in a position to fight a two-front war and that we should not invade Iraq. Well, I was then subsequently not asked to come back on any of the shows, even though they continued to pay me. And I found out later that Roger Ailes specifically had sent down word that I was not to be put back on air, because basically what I was saying that he thought was subversive. So that's where I learned that speaking out can have some consequences, financial and otherwise, but I wouldn't change it.
We're speaking with former CIA and State Department officer Larry Johnson. Stay with us. We'll take a short break and come right back.
If Ukraine's long-anticipated counteroffensive has indeed begun, then it's not off to a good start. This has not bode well for the Kiev regime, and more importantly, it is a testament to the ineffectiveness of NATO. Ukraine is failing, and so is NATO.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with former CIA and State Department officer Larry Johnson. Larry, thanks again for being with us. Larry, I think you surprised a lot of people with your criticism of the Obama administration that many saw being as harsh as your criticism of the Bush administration. Barack Obama was certainly no friend to whistleblowers, and he surrounded himself with a lot of bad people from the CIA. Is that what your objection was to Obama, or was it something deeper?
Well, the early days, I was just looking at his prior associations with, convicted terrorists, with Bill Ayers, with people associated with the Weather Underground. I mean, he was deliberately hiding his past, and it was, the image that he portrayed and presented to the American public was not consistent with his background. I mean, for example, when I pointed out that he was adopted by an Indonesian man, Lolo Sotoro, and actually I tried to gain access to those adoption records in Indonesia. And I had a friend of mine, a retired FBI hostage rescue team guy, who was actually over in Indonesia doing training at the time. And he went in to try to, he got with some of his buddies there and they tried to get access to the material. Well, found out it had all been cleaned out. Cleaned out by who? John Brennan. So Brennan had been active out working to help burnish Barack Obama's image. But, Obama like Bush. They're both frauds. And actually, in some aspects, I think Obama was more pernicious, particularly when you look at what was done in the overthrow of governments in Libya, the attempted overthrow of the government of Bashar Assad in Syria, the Maidan, the rise of the coup in Ukraine, which took out a duly elected president. May have been corrupt, but he was still duly elected. Obama was involved with the overthrow of more countries or attempted overthrow of more governments than George W. Bush, if you can believe that.
Another of the myriad problems that many former CIA officers have is with something called the Publications Review Board. Everybody who has ever worked for the CIA, even if you work there for 15 minutes, must submit everything that he or she writes to the Publications Review Board for clearance. The problem with the PRB is that they're highly politicized. If you write something that's pro-CIA, you get it cleared quickly. If you're critical of the CIA, you can be bogged down in the process for years. I've certainly tangled with them. What has been your experience getting your writing cleared with the CIA? Have they tried to silence you?
No, I've had very little. The only things that we presented, Milt Bearden and I did present that op-ed for clearance. That was it. What's really fascinating is CIA officers can go on any kind of television or radio, and they're not required to get that pre-cleared, nor is there any way to pre-clear that kind of thing. So in other words, what you may have written in a book, you could have just gone on television and said it, and they couldn't have done anything about that. And then once that's out there and the transcript's recorded, then you go, you know, then you're free. The other thing that's been interesting is they've not done anything to go after people writing blogs and such and opinion pieces. So it's a very inconsistent policy. It's really it has not caught up with technology. It's something that's rooted back when we were dealing with typewriters, and the only form of communication were in books and magazines and hard copy newspapers. The whole electronic age has, I think, really created some problems for them.
Larry, your detractors say that you're a bomb thrower, that you like to stir the pot. And you've been criticized in the past for saying that Michelle Obama used a racial epithet against white people, that John Kerry committed a war crime in Vietnam, and that the British GCHQ had tapped Donald Trump's phone. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, there are three different things going on there. The Whitey tape. That was given to me initially by Sid Blumenthal, Hillary's best buddy. And Sid reached out to me and said, "Hey, I've got this information. Can you check on it?" I said, "Oh, okay." So I started asking around. I checked with three different people, one of them a very respected journalist in Washington, D.C. And all of them confirmed, "Yeah, we've heard that too." Yeah, so I published that on my blog. Well, the thing went viral. And in fact, the Obama campaign put out a response claiming that, no, Michelle had said, "Why did he," not "Whitey." And I thought, boy, that's odd. Why would you come out and say, you know, give that explanation if there was not such a tape? But then with failure to appear, I went back and pressed Sid Blumenthal. I said, "Sid, where did this come from? Who's your source?" And he directed me to David Brock. Of Media Matters. So what it was, I got completely used, and I've apologized in writing for having been used by the Clinton campaign in that regard to spread that kind of disinformation. The whole thing about John Kerry, that was simply, I was repeating something that had popped up on the web, posted it on my blog. It lasted for about 24 hours, and then I took it down. So that whole John Kerry thing is a complete red herring. The British spying on Donald Trump? Absolutely, they did. And it was, as you know, the workaround, CIA cannot spy on American citizens, but there's nothing there that says British can't spy on American citizens, because they do. And the close relationship between the GCHQ and NSA, where they've actually got personnel that sit side by side physically, and it's easy to pass information back and forth. I know that was correct. I just didn't realize how extensive the involvement of both the FBI and the CIA was at the time. We've subsequently learned that this was a vast, vast intelligence operation directed against Donald Trump. In fact, I had one of our former colleagues who was, he was an SIS level, still in touch with folks back at the agency. He told me that one of his friends came and told him that he'd been approached by Brennan about joining what they called the Trump Task Force. And this was late summer of 2015. So, you know, that's the kind of activity that is completely illegal.
I'd like to thank our guest, Larry Johnson, for taking the time to speak with us. And thanks to our viewers for joining us again today. I'd like to leave you with the words of American author and poet Audre Lorde, who said, quote, "I have come to believe over and over again that what is most important to me must be spoken, made verbal, and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood," unquote. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for joining us on another episode of The Whistleblowers. Until next time.